Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Do you know a student getting ready to go to college? Or are you looking at going back to school yourself? The Woodward Hines Education Foundation and the Get to College program help more Mississippians get to and through college to get certificates and degrees that lead to meaningful employment. They offer free college planning advice, including hands-on FAFSA completion assistance through in-person or virtual appointments. Visit gettocollege.org to learn more.
Good morning. It's 8:30 on Thursday, March 7th. I'm Desiree Frazier. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, the State Senate's Elections Committee advances a bill to strengthen penalties for campaign finance violations. Then, folks included in and including in Mississippi will soon be able to buy birth control pills over the counter. Plus, some people are being indicted for crimes without legal representation, according to a new report from the Marshall Project. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Should politicians in Mississippi face stronger penalties when they don't turn in their campaign finance reports? That's a question Senate lawmakers are asking if they take up Senate Bill 2575. The measure would eliminate what some consider confusing language and fix penalties that may not be effective deterrents for late or wrongful filings. Our Will Stribling speaks about the issue with the author of the bill, Republican Senator Jeremy England of Van Cleve. He chairs the Senate Elections Committee and says there needs to be more accountability for candidates and fair punishments for all violations.
Transparency is key. We want to be as transparent as possible. We want candidates to report what they're receiving, what they're spending. Same for political committees. And we don't want any discretionary actions on whether we prosecute these or whether we impose fines. We don't want politics to get in the way of, well, we're gonna fine certain candidates and not others. These are the rules. They're going to apply to everybody here in Mississippi.
The provision to require online filing of campaign finance reports was taken out. I know that the intent of that provision was to have it be easily searchable. What are your thoughts on that provision getting removed and the reason behind it that was given by your committee members?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, the will of the committee was to make sure that we're not leaving anybody out. You know, they're still going to be required to file. They're just not going to be required to file online. And the purpose of that or the reason given for that was that, you know, we don't have access to internet as widely as what we hope to here in the future. When we get to that point, I think we'll revisit this. And again, look, now we're filing. We don't have to file online. We send our information to the Secretary of State's office, and they upload it online. So I will meet with their office and find out if there's a way that we can incorporate this in, because the goal ultimately is to have an online system that everybody can go to, see who's donating to which candidates, what those candidates are spending their campaign money on, and that it's searchable so that it's easy to find what you would like to find using the system.
So you imagine that the Secretary of State will work together to figure out a way to take these paper filings and make them searchable online?
I think they will, and I don't want to obligate them, just like we're not obligating others now to file online. I don't want to obligate them to have to get a bunch of statements in and put them into a new system. I want to talk with them and find out if that's possible. If it is, then we'll work on that. But again, the most important thing now is just making sure that people are that all entities are filing what they're supposed to file, when they're supposed to file it, and that it is a complete filing.
And then a reverse repealer was added to the bill. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I'm happy. I wouldn't say I'm happy the reverse repealer was added. I'm not surprised the reverse repealer was added. It's a big bill. It does a lot. Of course, the reverse repealer allows us to keep working on this throughout the legislative session, meaning that when we pass something on the floor, we know it's going to come back to us. If we send it with a reverse repealer over to the House, that at least has to be taken out. for it to survive. It gives us another month or so to talk about this and make sure that all of the committee members have a chance to speak on it. All members of the legislature have an opportunity to give input on this bill. And this is certainly a bill. I usually don't like reverse repealers. A big one like this, I think that's what the reverse repealer was initially designed to help, was to make sure that we're looking at all that we need to on these big omnibus-type bills on such important topics.
An amendment to SB 2575 was adopted by the committee to remove a requirement to file campaign finance reports electronically. Democratic Senator Hobb Bryan of Amory offered that amendment, saying the provision could create an unnecessary hurdle for candidates without a computer or internet access. Republican Senator Joey Fillengain of Sumrall supports that amendment. He thinks the requirement could disadvantage first-time candidates.
We did work out a lot of, I think, the questions that we all had, because it's such a new piece of legislation and it's pretty broad-ranging. So one of the things that I was curious about as I was reviewing the package yesterday in committee was what might be called sort of a forum shopping situation, where it sort of delineated that if the Secretary of State has investigated and found something that they think maybe is not completely accurate or the way it's supposed to be in the campaign reports, or I guess maybe even if you haven't filed a campaign report, that's clearly a violation, then they, as the investigator, then contact, it seemed to me, like the Attorney General's office. And then it also referenced a district attorney's office, and then it also referenced a outside counsel that could be brought into play. And I just wasn't sure what the hierarchy of that was, and like, how long do they have to investigate? And as an extension of that, what if the investigator at the Attorney General's office, for instance, does look into the allegations and finds there's no, problem, that the people, didn't have anything maliciously wrong on their reports or whatever, and they just decided not to prosecute it? Sort of seemed like in the wording of that bill that if the Secretary of State didn't get the answer they wanted with the AG, they could then go to the DA, and the same, if they didn't get the right answer at the DA's office, they could go to the outside counsel. So I just feel like maybe that part of the language needs to be tweaked a bit or clarified a bit to find out who's in charge, A, B, and C, and then what if people do investigate and find no wrongdoing, at what point can they just say so and close the case?
Yeah, what do you think should be done there? Because I imagine that those provisions were included because, there have been complaints that the current Attorney General is not interested in investigating or prosecuting wrongdoing in this arena.
Well, and part of it may be not just so much I didn't want to do something, but maybe it wasn't clear in the law that I had the authority to do something. So, that would be more my take on it, that people looked at the law and said, oh, well, that's the responsibility of the Secretary of State. And the Secretary of State looked at the law and said, no, that's really more the responsibility of the Attorney General. And they're both kind of sitting there pointing the finger at the other and not knowing, who has to move first and all that kind of stuff. So, I do think it's needful that we clarify all of that because, these are real issues and you don't want people going rogue and, not complying with the campaign finance laws. But at the same time, a lot of people, especially challengers, not necessarily incumbents, but challengers who are maybe just doing this all for the very first time, it can be very confusing. And if you're trying to fill out all these forms, you don't have a campaign staff, you're just kind of doing it yourself, as many people do at the first time out of the gate, then I don't think we need to make it so complicated that the average person wanting to get involved in the political scene can't do it. We don't want to shut people out that are not, staffed with lots of lawyers and accountants who can do all of these intricate things. So we shouldn't make it so complicated that it's essentially an incumbent protection plan either. That should never be the result of campaign finance reform or of our campaign finance laws, in my opinion. I feel like it should be about transparency because, I don't so much care how much money somebody gives to somebody else. I just want to know before the election so that I can see, person A got, X number of dollars and who gave that money. So we shouldn't be able to hide the amount of money, and nor should we be able to hide as candidates who gave us that money. But beyond that, I feel like the voters get to choose.
That's Republican Senator Joey Fillinghain from Sumrall. Up next, Mississippians will soon be able to buy birth control pills over the counter. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Humor, stories, news, music. Our weekend lineup has it all. Tune in to enjoy the relaxed sound of the weekends on MPB Think Radio.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. Pharmacies throughout Mississippi could soon begin stocking a birth control pill approved by the FDA to be sold over the counter called O-Pill. It's the first birth control pill ever to be sold over the counter nationwide. It was first introduced by prescription in 1973. O-Pill, as we mentioned, was approved by the Federal Drug Administration, is expected to hit store shelves later this month. Our Mike McEwen speaks with Michelle Colon with Shiro Mississippi. That's short for Sisters Helping Every Woman Rise and Organize. She says it's been a long journey to get pills like this approved for over-the-counter sale, and there may still be some hurdles.
It's about time. It's long overdue for birth control to be available without a prescription and available to, you know, purchase in your local local pharmacies or grocery stores or what have you. I think it's also great considering that there has been a aggressive and determined and dogged effort by anti-abortion activists and policymakers in regulating not only reproductive health but women's rights and women's health. And their bodily autonomy. So this is a good thing for the reproductive justice movement, reproductive rights, because it allows us to maintain some power, especially, you know, with so much power and access we've lost with post-Dobbs. So I totally support this. You know, I remember, almost 20 years ago, fighting for this, you know what I'm saying? Fighting for birth control, accessible birth control, and also emergency, you know, contraception to be available and to be available without prescription, and for teenagers or people who are under the age of 18 to be able to get this without parents' permission. So, you know, here we are almost, you know, two decades later, and we finally have this option. Now, there are some cons with it. Don't get me wrong. It's really great that this is available. You know, it does improve access, but it's not total access. You know, it will still be out of reach for some, because I want to say the price tag is anywhere between $40, $50. For low-income people, this is still a barrier. And, you know, in rural areas, I'm not sure, you know, honestly, especially in places like Mississippi, honestly don't believe that some of these mom-and-pop drugstores or pharmacies will carry it. So that still poses a challenge for rural areas, and especially anti-abortion states such as Mississippi.
So you said, you know, one of the many issues you've been fighting for about 20 years is emergency contraceptive or over-the-counter birth control. Why has it taken so long for it, you know, for that to be made possible?
Well, first of all, when I say for 20 years, I was in this fight for this. Like, this has been a 20-year battle for me personally, you know what I'm saying, in trying to get this. But why do I think it's been so difficult is because the anti-abortion policymakers and activism has been so successful in rolling everything reproductive health, everything reproductive rights, everything reproductive justice into being, you know, being that all of this is abortion, right? So birth control, you know, any type of birth control is the same thing in their minds as abortion, right? Whether it's condoms, pills, sponges, whatever, emergency contraception, to them, all of that is the same thing as abortion. So they have been successful for so long in, you know, holding up the process, you know, the progress, I should say, of you know, birth control being available and being readily available and being affordable, prohibiting its access. So that's the reason why it's been held up. Birth control pills, we know the birth control pills have been safe and been, you know, I mean, for, gosh, what, since the 60s? The fact that here we are in 2024 and finally now, and I think, honestly, this is because we're living in a post-Dobb society. You know, finally we get birth control available and accessible without a prescription.
Something that I've wondered with birth control now being made over the counter, that obviously skips the middleman, so to speak, in a doctor or a reproductive health specialist. In your experience with healthcare costs in this country, but especially healthcare costs in Mississippi, has, you know, reproductive care and accessing birth control, has that been hard to achieve before this because people just can't afford to see a specialist or a doctor?
Oh, absolutely. The other thing, so affordability is a part of the access, but the main thing is that we are living in Mississippi currently. There's so many people. Mississippians are basically living and surviving, or I should say existing, in a health care desert. You know, just within the last couple of years or like last year alone, there's been a mass exodus of healthcare providers that have left the state. You put that as far as there's not even an entity, there's not even a structure where people in Mississippi can go to within their communities, right? Because we know, yeah, they can come to Jackson, but let's be honest, not everybody can get to Jackson. That's the first barrier. And then the second barrier, yes, is the affordability.
Michelle Colon is co-founder of Shiro Mississippi. Next, some Mississippians being indicted without legal representation, according to a new report from the Marshall Project. You're listening to Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Mississippi Antique Showcase is coming to Natchez, Mississippi, Friday, May 3rd and Saturday, May 4th. We'll have professional appraisers on site evaluating antiques, furniture, and treasured keepsakes. For a one-time gift of $100, you'll receive one ticket, complimentary food, cocktails, and a single-item appraisal. Call 1-844-874-6874 or go to mpbonline.org to reserve your spot now.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Desiree Frazier. In Yellowbusha County, lawyers are in short supply to serve as counsel for low-income defendants. And according to a new report from the Marshall Project, only 20% of felony defendants were appointed attorneys in 2022. It's a practice that may violate the Sixth Amendment guarantee every defendant has a lawyer who cannot afford one. Reporter Caleb Bedillion with the Marshall Project speaks with our Kobe Vance about that report and why this issue is likely common in other rural states like Mississippi.
I have spent almost a year now looking pretty specifically at Mississippi's public defense, broadly speaking, but more specifically at the very early phases of a criminal case. Now, you know, criminal defense lawyers, public defense experts, constitutional experts, you know, are all pretty uniform that the beginning of a criminal case is pretty important. You know, if evidence goes missing, you know, that can happen very quickly and can't ever be recovered. Witnesses, you know, their memory fades. There are lots of reasons you want an attorney, both for the state, the prosecution, and the defense attorney, really taking a look at a criminal case very early. And Mississippi has just really struggled with that for a long time. Counsel often is not meaningfully involved until much later in the case after an indictment, which in Mississippi, you know, sometimes that may take months, but sometimes it may take a year or even more. Now, what I have found most recently is took a careful look at a recent year in Yellowbusha County. That's in North Mississippi. What we found by looking at cases in the justice court there, that's the one of the courts that sees cases very early. We found in 2022 of the cases we were able to identify, only about 20% of the cases got counsel appointed to the defendant. So of the new defendants who appeared in that year before one of the justice court judges, only 20% of those defendants had counsel appointed to them. Now, nationally, you know, a lot of experts, a lot of studies have reached the conclusion that the numbers of defendants who qualify for appointed counsel is about 80% or maybe even higher. So 20% is obviously a good bit lower than that.
How is this happening? What, in your conversations and your research, what has been some of the things that are leading to people going unrepresented?
Right. So obviously, the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution requires that if you're charged with a felony and cannot afford an attorney, the state must provide you with one free of charge. Now, that amendment requires some other things, and there are implications for misdemeanors, but my reporting is looking specifically at felonies. But the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't fully defined all the details about how that determination is to be made, when it's to be made. There is some guidance. The states have had to fill in some of the details. So in Mississippi, the first time you see a judge, the first time a felony defendant sees a judge, that judge, according to our state rules, should determine whether that defendant in front of them needs appointed counsel, whether they need a public defender. And so Yellowbusha County Justice Court has two justice court judges, and those are often the first to see a defendant there in that county. And so they've described their practices to me, and they are doing some things and how they're handling this process that, you know, our reporting says appear not to be consistent with what the rules require. So one judge, her account of her process is that she tells defendants they qualify for, you know, appointed counsel if they can't afford one. But, you know, in her telling, she's not specifically asking them any questions that would enable her to reach a conclusion as to their need for appointed counsel unless they bring it up. I spoke with a retired Supreme Court justice, former Chief Justice William Waller, who helped write these rules. And, you know, he was clear, that's just not what the rules require. The rules require the judge to reach a conclusion. And generally, that means the judge needs to be asking questions. You don't need to be waiting for the defendant to raise the issue.
Now, last we spoke, we were talking about a lack of public defenders in Mississippi. And we talked about how there are conversations ongoing about should Mississippi have some kind of centralized system. I wanted to get your thoughts on these stories and how they connect.
Yeah, so obviously one issue we've got is you have lots of different governments, local governments and counties that are figuring out their own system. And this really came out in the story that I just had come out. I followed one defendant who she appeared in Yallabusha County Justice Court. I explicitly did ask the first time she saw one of these judges, Trent Howell, for counsel. She was out on bond, and, you know, he declined to, you know, conduct any kind of a determination about whether she qualified for counsel. You know, what he told me was she didn't strike me as an indigent person. She later, on different charges, appears in Tupelo Municipal Court in Lee County, which employs a full-time public defender, and she gets a public defender virtually within 48 hours of her arrest in Tupelo after going, you know, about 8 months in Yallabusha County with no appointed counsel whatsoever. So that just shows what a wide disparity there is and how the local governments and the local courts are managing and running their public defense system. Some of it is a funding disparity, but some of it is just different attitudes by different judges on how they're going to go about things. There's very little consistency in our courts in this regard.
Okay, well, Caleb Bedillion, he's a reporter with the Marshall Project and ProPublica. He has a new article on the Marshall Project's website. It's worth checking out, looking into how courts in Mississippi operate. Caleb, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Coley. I'm so glad to be here with you.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.